Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, April 6, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss the right to try, America's prescription drug approval regime. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to begin today with two experts. We have Darcy Olson. She's president and CEO of Goldwater Institute. Importantly, she's also the author of The Right to Try, How the Federal Government Prevents Americans from Getting the Life-Saving Treatments They Need. It's a book available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. A link to the Amazon page has been provided in the promotional materials for this call, so it's easy for you to find. She's joined today by Evan Burnick. He's the Assistant Director at the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. We're going to hear some opening remarks and some back and forth between the two of them, but as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so be thinking of those for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Darcy Olson, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much for hosting this call. I'm very excited to hear from the listeners today and answer any questions that they might have. And just a little bit of background on what this is all about. In the simplest terms, the right to try is really the opposite of the right to die. This is about the right to try to save your life when your mortality hangs in the balance. And this year in our country, about a million Americans with terminal diseases are going to hear from their doctors that there really are no treatment options left for them and that it's time for them to get their affairs in order. But what physicians really mean is that there is nothing left in their FDA-approved toolbox of medicines. But the truth is that there are thousands of medicines, treatments, and even cures that are in the FDA's pipeline right now. Many of them are already available in Europe that could be, curing people and helping them live longer, better lives right now. In my book, I tell the story of a man named Ted Harada, and we call Ted Lazarus because he is the first known survivor of Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS. And Ted was very fortunate because he was able to get into a clinical trial where he received this treatment that reversed his ALS, which had never happened prior to this. But here we are, 7 years after his diagnosis. He's swimming with his kids. He's walking in 5K races. 31 other people lucky enough to be in that trial with him. But in the 7 years since that trial began, 24,000 other people in the United States have died of this disease, and they couldn't access this trial. And the heart of the problem is the FDA's long approval process for getting these treatments to market. And this is especially true for people with life-threatening diseases. It now takes an average of 15 years to bring a new drug to market at a cost of $2 billion. About 80% of oncologists say that the FDA's long process hurts their ability to give their patients the best possible care. During the course of writing my book, The Right to Try, I talked with a mother named Jen McNary, who has two boys with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. Most children with this will end up in wheelchairs and will pass away in their late teens. One of her boys got into a trial that's helping, and the other one didn't until she fought quite hard to get him in several years later. But, you know, what she says about this process is, and I quote, "By the time this drug for my boys is on the market, we are going to lose an entire generation of boys." That's what 15 years means in a situation like DMD. And we are arguing that it is unethical not to give those boys a chance at life, and that it is also unconstitutional. And I'm looking forward to drilling down and talking a little bit more in detail about why we believe that, and why we believe that this law, this right to try law, which we've now passed at last count in 27 states in less than 2 years, why we believe that if the FDA does sue a doctor or a patient or a manufacturer, why we will prevail in the U.S. Supreme Court should it go that direction.
So Darcy, this is Evan. I want to say to everybody who's listening on this call that this is really a remarkable and important book. It's shocking, it's sometimes heartbreaking, but it's ultimately a hopeful account of an ongoing tragedy and a growing campaign to put an end to it. You say it's been approved in 24 states at this point?
I love the fact that I've actually lost track. I think we're at 27 states. We just closed Maine in the last couple of weeks and Idaho. Mm-hmm. We've only had one veto so far from a governor, and that was Governor Jerry Brown in California. And he marches to the beat of his own drum. Mm-hmm. No one can really figure out why there was a veto there. He said he wanted to give a chance to the federal law. There is a federal compassionate use law to work, but that law has been in place for 30 years. So I think people felt like that was a bit disingenuous. But everywhere else, we've had governors on the left and right and very conservative states, very liberal states. And, you know, we started in the purple state of Colorado. So this is just something that I think... you don't have to be a member of the federal society to understand that, you know, fundamentally, freedom means nothing if you don't have the right to try to fight for your own life or help fight for your children's lives. And so one of the sponsors of this legislation said that, you know, this is a 2-minute decision, and the first one is for coffee. This is a no-brainer for regular folks. The only people who don't seem to understand how important it is for terminal patients to get access to the most promising drugs are some of the regulators at the FDA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just as an incidental note, as I understand it, California is a state in which you do have the right to die. You do have the right to refuse life-saving medication, but you do not have the right to try it.
Yes, and I think that's people find that pretty ironic, and I think that also sends a message, right? That's the political establishment sending a message, and you know that older people or people who are sick simply cost too much, and there are people who really think that. In fact, conducting interviews for the book, we asked Janet Woodcock, who heads the Center for New Drug Development, if she thought theoretically it would be a good thing if hundreds of thousands of terminal patients were able to access these promising medicines that are under study and in progress right now. And she sighed and said, well, it would be another burden on the healthcare system. So it's not an exaggeration to say that for some people, they think of systems, they think of costs on the government budget before they think of patients' lives. You will see that. You'll see the support for some people for the right to die because that's gonna cost them less, and that's not a quote burden on the healthcare system. And fortunately, Evan, most people don't think that way. Their first thought is, you know, oh my goodness, what if that were my son or my daughter or my loved one, my spouse or my mother who had that? And people would give their own lives for their loved ones, and certainly they will fight for this right to the end.
Now, how did you get involved in this cause to begin with?
We got a call from the Cancer Treatment Centers for America. And they had seen some other work that we had done protecting the right of workers to vote by secret ballot in a similar way, where we were passing state laws that the feds didn't like, but we said, this is an area that states traditionally have prerogative and we believe we'll win if we get in a contest with you. And they had seen that, and they came to us and said, we've got a problem. We promise to be the best treatment center for patients with cancer in the country. And we know that there are, you know, some of the best treatments that we could offer right now, we can't get our hands on. We cannot give our patients what they need because those things are under lockdown at the FDA, and some of them are 10 or even 15 years away from getting to market. And we have an ethical responsibility when we have that knowledge about what's out there to try to get it to our patients. And is there anything that you can do to help us? And we, there were five or six of us in that meeting, and some attorneys, some analysts, me, and we said, we don't know, but we're going to research this. And it took us about 3 or 4 months to really get to the bottom of this issue and figure out a way that we felt would give terminal patients access to these promising medicines in a way that would be ultimately judged constitutional. It wouldn't just be some kind of nullification effort that actually, at the end of the day, wouldn't save lives or have any teeth. So that's what we did, and that gave birth to the Right to Try movement. And then, of course, it's taken the country by storm, and we're just thrilled to see the embrace of this law by legislatures. I mean, even the most optimistic among us were surprised by the open arms, just because politics is the way that it is. People, for whatever reason, they don't want to vote for something. Personal politics get in the way, and so rarely do good things get done. And this is just something that we have seen is so personal to these sponsors. Everyone has had a family member, it seems like, or a really close friend affected by something like this, or who got into a clinical trial, or who didn't get in, or couldn't afford to keep going, or that kind of thing. That I think that's why this has cut above a lot of other issues that people believe in and are popular, but this they believe in, and it is deeply, deeply personal.
So how do these laws actually interact with the FDA's regulatory regime? What are their principal features, and how do they enable people to have access to drugs that have not made their way through all three stages of FDA approval?
So under a right to try law, you have to have a terminal condition, which is defined basically by your doctor, not necessarily by the disease. So it's patient centric. That's why it was written that way. And if your physician thinks that wants to basically prescribe one of these promising investigational drugs for you and thinks it's the best, then you can just go to and it has to be in at least phase two at the FDA. So it's out of the initial safety part of the testing. It has been proven. So it's been tested in labs, it's been tested on animals, it's been tested in humans. At this point, they're looking for efficacy and dosing. So if the doctor says, hey, I see this looks great for you, you've exhausted your other options, and it would be unethical for us to keep giving you those things, we know they don't work for you, the doctor and you can go to the manufacturer, or you can go, or just the doctor can go and ask the manufacturer, can we have early access to this? And if the manufacturer agrees, then they can start giving the treatment or drug or whatever it may be to the patient. And one of the criticisms of the law was, you know, people said no one is going to use this. I know for a fact that there are at least close to 100 patients that I know of personally who are being treated under the law. So not everyone who gets a treatment or gives a treatment is going to come to the Goldwater Institute, but we've been contacted by a lot of people who want to make sure that they're crossing all the legal I's and dotting all the T's and getting it right. And so obviously we take them into our confidence. But what we're seeing is that some of these manufacturers have no interest in putting something on the market early and getting crosswise with the FDA. But what we have also seen, though, are physicians who say, by the time the FDA approves this next best treatment, all of my patients will be dead, all of them. And I've had enough, and it's time for me to start treating people with the best available medicine. And they're willing to take that risk. And there are some really amazing people out there who are involved in this right now.
So you spend a lot of time detailing the nature of, what is often a slow, cruel, costly process. One of the most heart-wrenching chapters in your book focuses on the FDA's reliance upon double-blind placebo-controlled trials, which often forces parents of terminally ill children to make unfathomable choices, whether they are going to travel, miles to participate in the clinical trial and they have their child receive medicine that's not actually going to be effective and is just designed to test the efficacy of a medication. Can you tell me about these trials, why the FDA continues to require them, and what the consequences of doing so are?
Well, there, you know, there's a lot of debate about that in the scientific community, and a lot depends on what you're developing and who the population is. And, you know, it's one thing to have a double-blind study when it's pimple cream or foot fungus. It's an entirely different thing to have a double-blind study when you know that if you get the saline solution, you're going to die. And that does happen. And in fact, that mom that I was telling you about, Jen McNary, told me a story about a friend of hers who had gotten one of her children into a clinic, like a trial in Canada. So you can imagine the expense of going to Canada if you have multiple kids, you're going with one, who stays home? I mean, it's just these heroic efforts that these parents make, you know, only 4 or 5 months later to realize that they were on the placebo. And, you know, it's just, it's absolutely heartbreaking. And the FDA, I mean, one of the reasons for having these state right to try laws is to try to break some of this, this stranglehold, this monopoly over the control of, you know, everything and the way that it hits the market. A lot of these rules and the way that the FDA does things, you're just losing the common sense. And I'll give you one example. I tell the story in the book about a boy named Diego Morris, and Diego got, he was about 12 at the time, and he got a rare form of bone cancer. And to make a long story short, the best available treatment for him, all of the best doctors in the U.S. said, you need to go abroad to get this. And so he and his family actually had family in London. They moved there for 9 months. They got this treatment. It cured him. Fortunately, it worked for him. This particular medicine called MePact, or this treatment, has been the standard of care in Europe for more than 20 years. And it was such a huge advance in curing this childhood cancer that it won Europe's Nobel Prize in medicine, essentially. It's not called a Nobel Prize, but something like that. And when the manufacturers came to the U.S. To try to get it approved here, the FDA wanted them to test it on more than 900 patients. Well, you don't even have 900 patients a year who need it in the U.S. I mean, and so a lot of what they require, the double blinds, these extensive, you know, $1 billion, 10 more years of study, just come from this knee-jerk reactionary mentality of wanting to overstudy everything and refusing to accept the information that's coming from Israel or Japan or Europe, where, you know, often about 30% of the newest best drugs will come out of those places first. So one of the things that I call for to try to break the stranglehold that the FDA has over what we can and can't put into our bodies, I call for a policy called reciprocity, which is that if something is available in Europe, or, you know, you can pick from, you know, a dozen or so countries, something that's already been approved, like MePact, it should by default be approved over here and be available immediately, unless the FDA has some, you know, can prove that it's going to harm patients. And so, you know, we have so much redundancy to have the FDA doing this and the bodies, you know, the EMA in Europe, and it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to have to restudy everything at the point, you know, at the port of entry at the U.S. And so reciprocity would help a great deal, and I think would help to make the FDA more thoughtful in what it requires and more open-minded about best practices.
So, I mean, essentially, if you are a terminally ill patient for whom no FDA-approved drug is available that can effectively treat your disease, you either have to wait 15 years for a drug to be approved that by then is out of date and antiquated. You have to go overseas. You have to leave the country in search of a cure, or you can seek expanded access. And one of the, this is the only legally available means of accessing unapproved drugs outside of a clinical trial in the United States. And one of the things that defenders of the FDA's policies like to point out is the very few applications for expanded access to the drugs that are under FDA monitoring and are in development is that very few of these applications for expanded access are denied. And you go to some length to explain why this is misleading. Could you talk about that a little bit?
It's a complicated process, so I don't want to bore people with the details. But yes, the FDA says they have a compassionate use program. It's so wonderful. They approve almost all of the applicants. And isn't this wonderful? And this is much ado about nothing. Well, first of all, I think the fact that all of these states have passes in such rapid succession tells you that it's not much ado about nothing. In fact, there's a tremendous demand to get access to these medications. What happens is the application process literally takes a doctor over 100 hours to fill in this application. So they have to clear their desk. I'm not kidding you. This, we have like testimony on this, 40 hours a week of paperwork just to start the application process to get in. Over a year ago, after we had passed the right to try in about, I don't know how many states we'd gotten at that time, 10 or 15, the FDA came out and said, oh my goodness, you know what? The form is long and we're going to shorten it to 45 minutes. And we said, great, that's a good step, but you know, it's not enough. But here we are more than a year later, and they still haven't even shortened the application process. So ultimately, what you see is that less than 1% of all patients with terminal illnesses will ever get access to that. You're talking about you might get 1,000 people a year who get access through the compassionate use program. There are a lot of complicating factors. One of the big ones is that because it is so time-consuming, it's not something that physicians, even at specialty hospitals, like to do or fill out, right? I mean, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. You're trying to treat patients, not fill in paperwork. So that's a piece of it. The bigger piece, though, I think the bigger disincentive is that a lot of the companies don't want to participate because they are afraid, they're deathly afraid that if they give one of their promising drugs to someone who is already kind of at the end of the line, which by definition, people who are accessing right to try or compassionate use are, right? They have to have exhausted the conventional treatments. They're afraid if someone dies that the FDA, while taking this, that the FDA will say, hey, you know, Merck, that's your fault. And instead of $2 billion of testing and 6 years, you're going to spend $3 billion and it's going to be 10 more years. So they're really thinking about the bottom line, and you know, to some degree, obviously that makes sense if you're a company. But that is one of the big problems. And under the right to try, there's still that fear. That fear still exists. But you've got people who, what I would say is we're led by the bold. And so the people who are helping patients right now and the manufacturers who have been willing to step up are people who say, you know what, FDA, do your worst, but I've got lives to save.
So moving on to what actually got me interested in the subject in the first place is the constitutional law question. You depict the right to try movement as a series of political miracles and a vindication of federalism, and it certainly is. But the hurdle that you have to face is that the FDA's authority to regulate investigational drugs is conferred by federal law. It's well established that federal law preempts conflicting state laws. And although the FDA has not taken a position at this point, if they decide that the FDCA preempts right to try laws, it could seek to enjoin states from thwarting its regulatory efforts and try to subject drug manufacturers who distribute unapproved drugs to enforcement actions. You are highly confident in the fact that, yes, the Constitution actually does protect the right to preserve your own life, and that if the FDA ever does try to challenge these right to try laws, you will prevail in court. From whence springs that confidence?
Well, I've got, as you know, I've got a whole chapter on the legal arguments surrounding this, Chapter 9. And for the Legal Eagles, I would strongly recommend that. I am not an attorney, so forgive me for butchering the nuances here. But, you know, this is built on, you know, when we designed this, it took quite a while. And obviously, we were looking to design something that would be found constitutional. And it's based on a couple of different things. It stands on a few different legs. And as you know, and I'm sure most of the callers know, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld right to die laws. And at that time, 10 years ago, that's the Gonzalez case. At that time, people were saying exactly what you, how you sort of opened this question. It's going to be preempted. The feds have authority over this. And the state said, no, that's not in fact true. Historically, the states have had a lot of discretion over medical standards and licensing and other things. And ultimately, the court upheld the right to die. And we believe that a lot of the precedent that went into that decision will apply here. And there are a few other areas that are quite interesting, too. The fact that we have the right to refuse medical treatment like a DNR, there's some really interesting case law on the right to self-preservation. And then, you know, fundamentally, too, as theory goes, the U.S. Constitution, the federal law can't often prevails, but we have a fundamental liberty interest at stake here. And that creates a very different equation and a different question. So with that on the table, we in short think that with a court that has approved and upheld the right to die, that the right to try has an even better shot than it did.
What is the ultimate goal of right to try laws? To expand access, to persuade federal actors to address the problem, some combination of both?
It's a number of things. Number one, save lives, because what is freedom if you don't have the right to fight for your life, right? That is fundamental to who we are, and it cuts across all political persuasions. So number one, we want to save lives. Number two, we would like to see patients and doctors have more authority and control over patient treatments. And we want this to be less in the hands of government bodies and regulators and more in the hands of the patients where they belong, right? Patients should be able to make decisions about their lives, about their bodies, about their treatments. And that is very, very acute when you're talking particularly about when their lives are on the line. So we're glad to, the states can open this up quite a bit. Reciprocity would open that up quite a bit. The FDA could, and Congress can come out with some federal laws that allow, marketing of these products after stage one at the FDA so more people would have access. Almost any outcome at this point will be better than what we currently have. So we're trying to get that door open, and any of these directions that it could go, whether if the FDA sues, if it doesn't sue, we really don't know. If Congress adopts reciprocity, what might that do, right? Could we get a lot more treatments available to patients more quickly? So we are trying to save lives in the short term, but we're also trying to change the conversation and make this an issue that has to be addressed, not just for the terminally ill, but for all patients in America to have these freedoms and access to the best available care.
So, as I mentioned earlier, and as you've described, the right to try is full of stories. Some are tragic, some are inspiring, some are both tragic and inspiring. If there's one story that you think best captures what the right to try movement is all about, what are the stakes, why you fight for this right, what would it be?
I would say it's the story of Andrea Sloan. Andrea, right? Texas passed their law, and it's the Andrea Sloan Right to Try Act, and it was named after her. She was in her 30s. She was an advocate and an attorney. She quit her, a high-paying job to go advocate and fight for justice for some populations that were underrepresented where she was, and just a full-hearted, really magnanimous, dynamic woman. And she got a terminal diagnosis. They had exhausted all of the options, and she was a fighter, and she was someone who was in the know, just like you would be or I would be, right, with connections and all of those things. And they fought and fought and fought to get access through the federal government's compassionate use program. And by the time they finally got through there, she got a pneumonia, which took her life. And, it was within, a couple weeks of approval, but it was too late. Even though, 4 or 5 months later, the drug that she had been so desperate to get came onto the market. And, they were doing the packaging, of it to get it ready for pharmacy shelves, and she couldn't get it. And, maybe it wouldn't have saved her life, but all signs point to the fact that it would have, and it should have. And, it is a tragedy when people get these illnesses, when they are young and when there are, no cures or good treatments available, but, when there is something available and you lose your son or your daughter or your spouse, it's just unconscionable. And that's what the right to try is about. No more deaths or, hideous suffering, just because the government, is barring the door to treatment.
Well, yeah, again, I would highly recommend the book to anybody that's listening. It's a very powerful book, and despite the fact that there are many tragic stories, it really is saturated with the confidence that eventually, as you put it at the end, the dying children will win, and the right to try will be secured. People who are terminally ill will have access or be able to acquire experimental drugs from those that are willing to provide them on the advice of their doctor. And the most fundamental of all rights that the Constitution guarantees, the right to preserve your own life and maintain your own life, will be protected. I don't really have any further questions. If we want to open it up to Q&A from anybody who's listening, I'd like to do that.
Yes.
That sounds great.
Let's do that. This is Dean Reuter. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, we're speaking to the author of the book, The Right to Try, How the Federal Government Prevents Americans from Getting the Life-Saving Treatments They Need. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a few callers. Just one question to begin. Let's go to our first caller of the day.
Fred Young in Wisconsin, Darcy.
Hey, Fred.
Hey. I have a question. Are you using ALEC, the Legislative Exchange Council, to promote your cause among the states?
We always work with ALEC, but this is one of those situations where, sponsors came to us looking for this. So we really didn't require ALEC's assistance on this. And the other thing is, Fred, too, ALEC traditionally, of course, works with conservative legislators. And it was very important to us that if this was going to sweep the country, that it be bipartisan, because, in fact, it is. And so that I don't think that would have been the right lead for us, although we're always grateful to have partners on these things.
That's a good point. Good luck to you, Darcy.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open at this point. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who else might ring in, let me mention our next scheduled telephone conference call Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about intellectual property cases in the Supreme Court. Today, of course, The Right to Try, the book by the same title. Push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. We've got one more question pending. Then our lines are wide open. Let's take another call now.
Hi, this is Marianne McGrail, an attorney in Washington, D.C., and a breast cancer survivor. I really admire your work. My concern is that patients who are in terminal stages of in the final stages of a terminal disease, or who fear they may be, might be inclined to try remedies that will do them a great deal of harm. So I'm wondering if you could comment on that aspect of this issue.
Marianne, that's a great question, and I love your story. Thanks for sharing that with us, and that's the kind of outcome we want to see more of. So this was designed. You are right that when people get these diagnoses, you know, that we're susceptible to, you know, anything that looks like hope sometimes. And so this is very conservatively designed to, you know, the what you can take under this has to be something that has passed the phase one safety testing at the FDA. And one thing I didn't mention is it also has to be undergoing current study. So these are what you would call traditionally legitimate things that are on their way, and they're the basic safety has been proven, and at this point they're looking for dosing and efficacy. The other thing is that to access these things, you know, your doctor has to say and believe that, you know, you've exhausted the standard treatments. So it would be really a choice between at that point between, you know, getting your affairs in order or taking this last chance. And that really is a that's a risk question, and it's a personal question, and I believe it's a question that really belongs to the patient and not to regulators. It's a hard decision no matter who you are, and it's incredibly personal. So, you know, you certainly could you know, hasten your death, but it's the same exact risk that you would have in a clinical trial. You know, same ethics apply, but at least we're giving people the chance and the choice. One of the other good positives of this is that because people can't access promising drugs, and if you can't afford to go to Europe to get some of these treatments, you do fall into the hands of the snake oil salesman, and you kind of take anything. And we're actually hoping that while we can't calculate this, that lives will be saved by giving people some of the most viable, promising options, you know, rather than just you know, some shack and clinic somewhere. You know, we really hope that we're helping to open doors to the best available treatments.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open at this point. This is Dean. Let me maybe challenge. Well, here we have another question from our audience, so I will defer. Come back to you with a question if I have one, but let's go to the audience now.
Hello?
We can hear you. Go right ahead, sir.
Oh, hi. My name is Stephen DeGene, and I'm an attorney in New York. I missed the first 5 minutes, so I don't know if this was discussed or not, but is there a movement to maybe pass a law, you know, instead of doing it state by state, but actually pass a law with Congress, where, like, Congress could restrict the authority of the FDA to deny, you know, like life-saving drugs to terminally ill patients?
Yeah, Stephen, I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, we would love to see Congress come in and just fix it. But, you know, they have all the time in the world. And the problem is every time a decent bill gets written, it just gets killed and hung up in a committee, just like almost everything else, right? It's just a logjam there. So there are people working on that, and that's fantastic. But, you know, we really felt like we're not going to put all of our eggs in that basket because, you know, it's been since the 80s, really since the HIV activists helped to get compassionate use in the first place, where we've seen anything major at the federal level. And I'd love to see it. I don't want to be pessimistic, but we're certainly not going to wait on Washington. And what we're hoping is that the FDA can hear us now. You know, we hope that they see how many millions, more than half of the states have, you know, have passed this. And we're talking big states like Texas, you know. So hopefully they'll listen. It will drive some reform. But if it doesn't, then we're just going to have to do it ourselves. But one way or another, you know, we're going to fix this.
Right. Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've still got some time left. While we wait, let me ask a question that might challenge you a bit, if I could. And again, let me mention the name of the book. It's the well-titled The Right to Try. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it through the link we provided in the promotional materials for today's call. I want to know, is big pharma or even the, you know, the medium-sized pharmaceutical companies, are they universally on your side in this? And so it's a two-part question, I guess. That's part one. Part two, you mentioned you're about saving lives. And I'm wondering if there is some concern that if one or two people get into get access and they have a bad outcome, that a drug that is pretty far along in terms of being approved, you mentioned it could be delayed. It goes from, you know, $2 billion in six more years to $3 billion in nine more years. So it makes good business sense sometimes not to give access. But I'm also wondering that when you go from 6 years to 9 years, just using your hypothetical numbers, that's three additional years you're layering onto a long process. I wonder about the people that wouldn't benefit from the medicine during that additional 3 years, if you follow that question. It's a little convoluted.
I know where you're going with that. I mean, and that, you're right. I mean, that's the calculation that, that most of the large pharmaceuticals are making. I'm not sure that the question of lives is really on the table for them. It's money. You know, they don't want a bad outcome to get in the papers and, you know, drive down the price of the stock and have the FDA come out and require them to be in years and years more testing. You know, and the reason I say it's really a bottom line calculation is because I do think there's a little bit of middle ground for them. The FDA has not has done that in one or two cases, but really hasn't done it that often. I mean, it's a fear and it makes sense, but it's also a bit overblown. And you know, the really large companies, they're driven by the bottom line. And I'm a capitalist. I'm not going to criticize that, but it obviously, you know, it has a real effect here. You asked if Big Pharma and the pharmaceuticals, you know, are with us on this. The big, you know, the top roughly 20 largest pharmaceuticals in our country really haven't changed hands in the past 20 or 25 years, and they have remained neutral on this, but they don't favor it. You can tell from the statements, and we think that the reason is that the system, as expensive as it is, tends to favor the biggest companies now, because if you're a little startup doctor and you've got this idea and you think you've got something that can cure your patients, which is actually how a lot of these breakthroughs happen, you're not somebody who can probably also raise $2 billion in venture capital, start a company, and wait 15 years to get this through the FDA. It's not a viable option for you. So what's happening under the current system, because it is so expensive, is all of these smaller, all the people who are doing the startups and the innovation, they end up selling to the big manufacturers, and the big manufacturers don't have to pay as much for the R&D anymore. So they benefit. It in a lot of ways, it's keeping out their competition. So we have heard from some smaller companies, and they support this and they like this, but this is, so far we're not getting a lot of support from Big Pharma. And I'll tell you that when I speak to people in Congress about this, you know, they'll say that pharma is, you know, is not in support, and that's the reason that, you know, it's been 30 years since there's been a big reform in this direction.
Once again, we're in the Q&A session. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let's check in with our next caller.
Hi, good afternoon. Gerard Lehman from the Boston chapter. Pharma, by the way, but don't seek to address the last question. I have a different question. Apologies if you touched on it earlier, but I'm wondering if you see, or any of our like-minded folks have seen, any connection between what you're trying to do and the recent developments in cases of heparin and Coronia. They're distinct, they're different, but I'd say that the common denominator is your effort, and those cases are kind of linked by trying to give doctors or the prescriber community generally more tools and information without, you know, the FDA regulation inhibiting as it does now. So I'm just curious if you see the action, or if you see the successes in Amarin in particular as any bellwether for further developments. Thanks.
You know, I'm sorry, Evan, I don't know if you could hear that question better than I could, but there were some key words.
There was distortion, and I missed a lot too.
So I couldn't actually hear what he was trying to connect two movements, but I don't know what the other.
Let's check in with the caller.
I missed that as well.
Let's see if we could get. Yeah.
Were you talking about off-label uses, or what were you talking about there?
Correct.
Yeah, so yes. he's talking about off-label uses. If you could first, in answering that question, Darcy, if you could explain what, for our listeners, what that means, and then if you could address whether there are some similarities between off-label uses and your movement.
Yes, that's a good question. So, and I wish I could remember the statistic on this, but a great deal of treatments today for cancers are actually, you know, you'll have a medicine that was approved for a colon cancer, and a doctor thinks for some reason that this might actually help with a stomach cancer or some other version, and they give you the treatment that would be called off-label. So it's legal to do that, but it's for a different use. And yes, I do. I think that they're linked in this sense that physicians, when we talk to them about this, are so very aware that they are limited in the treatments that they can give their patients and the dance that they have to do to be able to try to help their folks with the best available medicines. And so I think that is that's a common equation there. And I think that the widespread use of off-label prescribing is, you know, one more testament to the fact that we're really not moving quickly enough for where the needs are in this country to meet the patient's needs.
Thank you for that and your patience with my technology.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. Our lines are wide open. My understanding, this is Dean, of the off-label usage, is that doctors are free to prescribe, but the pharmaceuticals that might have made a medicine for heart disease and it has some efficacy for cancer cannot market it to doctors or even, I guess, to the public as a cancer drug. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. And we actually think we're doing some research into this, but there may be some First Amendment issues there too that might help us open this up a little bit further, right? And in other words, they have a finding and they're not allowed to talk about it, and that may not ultimately hold up, even though that's the current practice. So we're investigating aspects like that. And in fact, I'm so glad that this has come up, because you've got the right people on this call for this. If there are areas where you think that you see openings or toeholds like this to expand medicine using the state constitutions or a precedent that may not be widely talked about but maybe influential, we would love to hear from you. This kind of law, when you are trying to expand freedom against a state that a federal state that is largely extra constitutional at this point, you know, it takes a lot of minds and a lot of creativity, and you know, sometimes we're pushing uphill. So if you have thoughts, please do share them with us. I would really appreciate that. And you can find anybody at Goldwater Institute, or just do info@goldwaterinstitute.org.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I think Darcy and Evan, we've had that final question. Let me get back to each of you now for a chance to express a final thought or wrap up if you'd like. Why don't we start with Evan? Evan, thank you first of all for your participation here. Do you have a final thought?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier in the call, my interest in this this whole issue, the reason that I made my way through Darcy's book, and I'm glad that I did, was because of my focus on judicial engagements. Judicial engagement is the idea that every time the government tries to compel you to do something or deprives you of your liberty, it needs to offer a compelling justification, grounded in reliable evidence and a legitimate purpose of government. And making one's way through the precedents that are relevant to the right to try cases in the federal courts, the Supreme Court has really not said anything definitive on the issue, although it ultimately, I think, will have to. you really see the degree to which you have in our constitutional law a division between the way in which the courts approach certain kinds of rights, which they treat as fundamental, and all other rights, which gets the default standard of review in constitutional law, the rational basis test, which is very, very deferential and essentially means that you lose. So if the right to try is going to be effectively enforced and it's going to be protected, if it's going to survive these legal challenges, it needs judicial engagement. Judges need to put the government to its proof instead of deferring to agency expertise or the purported good intentions of legislators or, in this case, agency officials.
Thanks, Evan. I appreciate that. I appreciate that you took the time to read it and study it out. And I think there are some really interesting questions. And still, obviously, it's, you know, we're in some ways reading tea leaves as to what the court will do. You know, it's we have some past things to look at. You know, we had the right to die contest between, you know, the state of Oregon and the feds, and of course Oregon won that, and the states prevailed. You know, that's one way to win something like this. Another that's kind of interesting, and these laws may go this way, which, you know, if you look around the country, I'm not sure the number, but 20 or so states have legalized medical marijuana, or even sometimes for recreational purposes. And what happened there, you know, had been occasional federal raids that we've all read about, but the Obama administration basically said, we're just not going to enforce the Federal Controlled Substances Act on this particular drug. And so you have a situation where for 15 years now, states have been, you know, I mean, they're in the business, they're collecting taxes on these marijuana shops, and yet federal law says you can't do that. So we could end up in a situation like that for a while, too. It's really hard to say. But, you know, we will continue to move this through more legislatures. I know we will continue to see more patients whose lives will be saved, more doctors coming out with this. We'll continue to push for reciprocity and some change in Washington. But of course, we won't wait on that. And I just, you know, conclude on this issue. For me, not being an attorney, I'll lift that final note to you. But for me, just from a purely moral perspective, a place of principle and the right to try to preserve your own life, we use the analogy in this case of, you know, if you were on a sinking ship, would you pass on the only lifeboat because the government hadn't certified it yet? You know, you'd say no, put the lifeboat in the water, and you'd probably have an expletive in there. I think it's fine to debate, you know, the best ways to make better, stronger lifeboats. How are we going to afford those lifeboats? But for heaven's sake, there is just absolutely no moral or ethical argument for withholding the lifeboats we do have from people who are drowning. So even though I know we might debate which is the cleanest approach and which one will ultimately be upheld in court, I'm glad that we can stand together on the principle of this, that this is something worth fighting for. And if one door closes, we'll push to get the next one open, because this has to be done. It is an absolute freedom imperative.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. My thanks to Darcy Olson and Evan Burnick. This has been a very interesting call today. We certainly appreciate you taking time out of your schedules to join us. Thanks also to the audience for calling in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled call is Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, intellectual property in the Supreme Court. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.